Okay, fun seekers, you're about to embark upon a journey for which very few people will ever take. You're going to learn how we actually value stocks. I mean, in the academic sense. I mean, from an analytical sense. They're really valued by the marketplace, right? And that's what we learned in Chapter 5. We learned all about the marketplace, and we learned about characteristics of stocks, and you need to know all that. But now we're going to attempt to actually put a number on the value of a single share of stock. As we're going to learn, it ain't easy. We start with a quote from a mutual fund manager with many years of experience, Greg Ireland. And he said very plainly, value matters. You ignore value at your peril. So all those folks playing the loser's game, buying high and selling higher, whatever you want to call it, the greater fool theory, I like to think of it as musical chairs. Beware. Slide number 2, stock valuation. The process by which the underlying value of a stock is established on the basis of its forecasted risk and return performance. Risk and return, they go together. At any given time, the price of a share of common stock depends upon investors' expectations about the future behavior of the security. It's all about the future. A fundamental assertion of finance holds that the value of a stock is based on the present value of its future cash flows, which, in the case of a business, are earnings. In other words, what cash is coming in through the door for whatever goods and services you are selling. The worth of a company is primarily based on the earnings the company will produce in the future. But if we knew what was going to happen in the future, it would not be called the future, would it? Yeah, right. Slide number 3. Here's a quote from Professor Burton Malkiel, who wrote A Random Walk Down Wall Street, and it's one of the books on the bibliography, and it's one of the books you want to read eventually. The most fundamental influence on stock prices is the level and duration of the future growth of earnings and dividends. However, future earnings growth is not easily estimated, even by market professionals. Who is Professor Malkiel? Well, he and many others in the late 60s, early 70s worked on quite a bit of the research that came to be known as the random walk theory, the efficient market theories about markets. And he was instrumental. In fact, I think he was on the board of directors of Vanguard for many years in the movement toward index funds. In other words, most people can't beat the market, so don't try. Just buy the market and live with it. So it's one of the books you want to read eventually, but read one up on Wall Street first, okay? Good. So now, if someone were to ask you, for example, on an exam someday, maybe soon, what is the most important factor in determining the future value of a company? In just a few words, you could say future earnings. Or maybe you could say future dividends, if the company's paying dividends. But do any of us know what's going to happen in the future? No. So is valuing stock going to be easy? No. As Professor Malkiel says, even market professionals have a very difficult job doing it. Witness the random walk theory, which we'll discuss later, the market efficiency theory, and the fact that many market professionals couldn't beat a monkey throwing darts at a dartboard. randomly buying stocks often, but not always, beat the market professionals. Slide number 4, security analysis. The process of gathering and organizing information and then using it to determine the value of a share of stock. And what we're after, folks, is the intrinsic value, not what the market says it's worth. That may or may not be a good value. We're looking for the underlying or inherent value of a stock as determined through security analysis. And of course, the question is, what security analysis methods or measures does one use to determine the intrinsic value of a company? Does one use future dividends, potential capital appreciation, price to earnings ratio, financial ratios, past price performance, the amount of risk? Value is in the eye of the beholder. Slide number 5, fundamental analysis. There's a reason why a few of the slides that passed us by had the word fundamental. And folks, it has nothing to do with religious fundamentalism. No. Fundamental analysis is the examination of a firm's accounting statements and other financial and economic information to assess the economic value of a company's stock. Examples of some of the fundamentals, as they're often called, are the competitive position of the company, growth prospects for company and its market, profit margins and the company's earnings, what assets are available, the company's so-called capital structure, how much debt, how much equity. Simply put, the value of a stock is influenced by the performance of the company that issued the stock. Now, doesn't that make sense? Yes, in my humble opinion, but there are others that poo-poo all this and say, oh, no. You want to use what is called technical analysis. And we'll discuss technical analysis much later in chapter 8. We'll discuss technical analysis much later. Let's concentrate on fundamental analysis, chapter 6. The first analysis technique we will use is financial ratio analysis. And it's actually at the end of the chapter in chapter 6, but I put it at the beginning because it's the easier one to comprehend. So my apologies, you'll find it at the end of chapter 6. Financial ratio analysis is just one method of security analysis that involves looking at certain financial ratios. Financial ratios give us a quick and easy method for comparing one company to other companies within their industry or the stock market as a whole. The problem with financial ratios is that there is no single financial ratio that can adequately sum up or summarize the overall general state of affairs, the situation, the predicament, etc., that a company finds itself in. So you can't just, look at the PE, or look at the interest times interest earned, whatever the ratio happens to be, and say, that's the reason I'm buying this stock, or that's the reason I'm not buying this stock. You have to look at all of them, and in the context of the industry, their competitors, and the stock market as a whole. We already took a look at a couple. We looked at dividend yield and earnings per share. These are ratios, and price to earnings ratio. So the first financial ratios we will investigate for security analysis will be the price ratios. And we'll look at others, many others, later on in chapter 17. So, slide number 7, the price to earnings ratio. So we looked at this, right, in chapter 5, and we're going to look at it again, and then we're going to look at it again and again. Because it's certainly the most popular stock market statistic. Very simple. You take the price and divide it by the earnings per share. And historically, P.E. ratios were in the 5 to 12 range for mature companies, 14 to 20 range for growing companies. Greater than 20 was highly unusual. But in the 1990s, well, 1980s, 1990s, the great run-up, it was commonplace. Now, P.E. ratios are all over the map. And so we've chosen 3 companies, all of which begin with the letter H, and that's about all they have in common, folks. But the reason I chose them is to just show you the incredible range of PE ratios. Hormel. Who's that? Spam. Right? They're a meat processing and food processing company. And look them up. The PE as of, what is it, December? I'm sorry, February. We're in February 10th, 2012. Was around 16, 17. A respectable PE. Not very low, but not high. Hewlett-Packard, HP as they like to be called now, was 6 or 7. This is a member of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. But they've hit on some hard times lately, mostly because of the incredible, I don't want to use the word mismanagement, but let's say quirky management things that have gone on the last few years where they ousted one CEO to put in another CEO and he was supposedly doing a good job and then he got involved with some picadillos with the BlackBerry messages being sent. I don't know, hanky-panky stuff. And then they replaced him with somebody else, and he didn't last a year because he was going to get out of the PC business. And everyone said, are you guys crazy? And what does HP make most of their money off of, folks? Do you know? Ink. Toner, right? That's right. Not the printers, and not so much the PCs and the computers they sell, but the ink that they sell, right? So their PE is tiny compared to the market and compared to other companies and what their business is. And then Hyatt, the hotel company. Yeah, a hotel company. Check them out. They got the letter H, Hyatt. On this February 10th, 2012, the PE was over 100. 100? What's going on? Well, we really don't know, but we need to do some investigation. Either investors have bid up the price because they are incredibly optimistic about Hyatt's future earnings, or the earnings could have fallen like a stone and the market price didn't fall with it. So you folks who understand, you know, the denominator and the numerator, if the numerator gets really big or the denominator gets really small, right? So if the earnings just all of a sudden fell and the market price didn't go down with it, the P-E ratio would be high. But normally that means when the P-E is very, very high, it means investors are incredibly optimistic. But we definitely need to do some research about that. So you understand? P-E's are all over the map. Slide number 8. Historically, a company's PE ratio was supposed to match its growth rate. If a company was growing at, say, 20% a year, then a PE of 20 was justified. During the internet bubble, many companies had PE ratios in the hundreds. At one time, I will never forget this, I looked down at the Quotron. You don't see those anymore, the internet has taken advantage of those, and I think they're gone. But they were proprietary telecommunication systems for brokers. I looked down at the Quotron, and eBay's PE was 10,000 in 1999, during the mania. At that PE, it would take eBay 10,000 years to earn back its price. You understand? Growth stocks typically have high PEs, while value stocks typically have low PEs. But remember our discussion of growth versus value? Be careful, the way the industry uses value scares me. A value stock, just because it has a low PE, might not necessarily be a good value. The PE ratio tells you how long it will take in years, assuming no changes in earnings, and of course they're changing all the time, for the company to earn back its price. A PE of 3 will take 3 years. A PE of 20 will take 20 years. You understand? It's going to earn every year a certain amount of money, and the PE tells you how many years it'll take back to earn its price. It doesn't mean you're going to get that money. That's the earnings. They could keep it. They could pay it out as dividends. So a PE of 10,000, what were investors thinking? We were worried about the Y2K problem back in 1998, 1999. They should be worried about the Y5K problem when we go from 9,999 year, the year 9,999 to the year 10,000. Right, because that's how long, and add another 2,000 years, for eBay to have earned back its price. Why aren't we worrying about the Y5K problem? We need to get started now. Oh, excuse me. Excuse me. Okay, so now, there are other price ratio models. Slide number 9, price to cash flow. Instead of using earnings, we could use cash flow. Well, it's the same formula. You take the current price and you divide it by the cash flow per share. But wait a minute. Why would cash flow be different than earnings? Aren't they the same? No. Cash flow often differs from earnings per share for several reasons. One major reason is depreciation. So you accounting students, you accounting majors will know exactly what I'm talking about. Depreciation is not an actual cash expenditure. You don't write out a check to depreciation. Right? It's just an accounting entry that allows you to reduce your earnings. Now, why would you want to do that? Very simple. You pay fewer taxes. That's a good thing, right? But that money still came in the door and didn't leave. But there are many other reasons why cash flow and earnings differ. And what you'll hear or read when you analyze companies are the phrases good quality earnings and poor quality earnings. Huh? Earnings are earnings, right? Aren't they good? Well, during the internet mania, here's a wonderful example. Many companies were reporting record earnings. But at the same time, the cash flow was negative. Their checkbooks were going down, not up. How could that be? That doesn't make any sense. Well, actually it does when you look at the dynamics of what was going on. In the late 1990s, the urge to flood the world with telecommunications was tremendous. So companies that were making telecommunications equipment were selling this stuff as fast as they could make it, but often to companies that were just starting out and had no, money to buy this stuff. So here's the wonderful example, Lucent Technologies, which you may have heard of, you may not have heard of, but it used to be part of the Bell system. It used to be Western Electric Bell Labs, right? They were the people who made the equipment for AT&T. Well, AT&T spun them off, and they were their own company. They still are, but they merged with a French company now. And what they were doing is they were selling telephone equipment and internet equipment like crazy to companies like Windstar. Have you ever heard of Windstar? Most of you haven't, and if you have, it was only a fleeting pfft when they went out of business. And Lucent Technologies were selling them equipment, but these people didn't have the cash to buy it, so what they did is, hey, Lucent, we want to buy $2 billion worth of telephone equipment and internet equipment and wireless equipment. Will you sell it to us? And by the way, will you lend us the money to buy it? So sure, Lucent was saying, yes, we'll sell you the equipment and you can pay us $50 million a year for the next, 30 years or whatever. Right. Windstar and all the others are gone. So Lucent Technologies got their equipment back, but it's already 2 or 3 years old, which means it's already up. You understand what happened? So they had very poor quality earnings. They were earning quite a bit of money, but because they weren't actually getting the cash now, So you have to be careful. Slide number 10, price to sales, yet another ratio. The current price divided by annual sales per share. Historically, a higher price-to-sales ratio suggested a higher sales growth, and a lower price-to-sales ratio suggested a lower sales growth. And it's the same formula, folks. You take the current price, but this time you divide it by the sales per share. And during the internet mania, many analysts were using price-to-sales instead of price-to-earnings or price-to-cash flow, since most of all of the new companies never, ever generated any earnings and didn't look as though they were going to generate earnings for many years. And most all of those companies are gone or just a shell of what they were during the internet mania. The last price ratio is the price to book ratio, book value. That's something you looked up in chapter 5, right? The current price divided by the book value. So it's called price to book. Historically, if the price to book ratio was greater than 1, then shareholders believed that the firm was creating value above and beyond the physical assets of the corporation. The book value of a stock is the value of the assets the company possesses. So historically, the book value was close to the price of the stock because people were afraid that if the company went under, there had to be some kind of assets there for the stockholders to grab onto. But today, it's rarely close to the price of the stock, and it makes sense. It does make sense. Isn't Coca-Cola or Walmart or IBM, aren't these companies worth more intact than if you were to liquidate them and sell off all the assets? Of course they are. It's the same thing is true with a pizza shop or a taco shop. I mean, the assets are just a fraction of what the company is worth because if you were to liquidate the company, oh yeah, you wouldn't get very much for the assets. So because the company is in business and a going concern, as the IRS uses the term, it's worth more than just the physical assets. Now, there are times when the market price, current price, falls below the book value. And those are very dangerous times for a company. Right. Why? Because if those assets are bona fide, if they're real assets that could be liquidated, corporate raiders, as they're often called, could swoop in, buy the company, just get 50% plus one of the stock, and liquidate the company. Sell off all the assets, pay off all the debts, and walk away. So it's a very dangerous time for companies. Okay, so now how do we make money with it? How do we use these price ratios to predict future stock prices? Well, slide number 12. What we do is multiply a historical price ratio by the expected future value price ratio denominator. What? Huh? Yeah, it's harder to explain than it is to do. Essentially, what we're going to do is we're going to say, okay, if this is the historical P/E ratio, and we're currently earning this much, what do we expect to earn next year? And the price should move that way. So the example on page 104 in the 6th edition, and it's in the 5th and the 4th and the 3rd edition too, folks, just different pages, is Intel. In late 2009, Intel's price was $19.40, and the earnings per share in late 2009 were 92 cents. Going back 5 years, we find that the price-to-earnings ratio over the last 5 years between 1999 back to I'm sorry, 2000, did I say 2009? Back to 2000, I guess that would be 5, right? 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, right? That's 5 years. It was 20.96. And the analysts were projecting 8.5% growth in the earnings per share. So the calculation is actually very easy. You take the historical PE and you multiply it times the projected earnings per share. And the projected earnings per share is simply the current earnings per share times 100%, that's 1, the current earnings per share, plus whatever the expected earnings per share growth rate. So here is the formula. The historical PE of 20.96 times the 92 cents of earnings per share that we're earning right now times 100% plus 8.5% or 0.085. That's 1.085. So if you multiply those three through, you get an expected price next year of $20.92. So you see, it's a very simple calculation. If we expect the earnings per share to go up by 8.5% and the P/E ratio doesn't change, a big assumption, don't you think? Excuse me. Then the stock price should go up 8.5%. It's actually very simple. Do it a couple times, and then maybe the explanation might make sense. Slide number 13. Same thing for price to cash flow. We do the exact same calculation. We take the cash flow per share. This is late 2009. And take a look at the 5-year price to cash flow ratio of 10.85. And the analysts tell us that they believe the cash flow per share next year will grow by 7.5%. So our expected stock price is the historical price to cash flow ratio times the projected cash flow per share. 10.85 price to cash flow ratio for the last 5 years times the current cash flow per share of $1.74 times 100% 1 plus the 7.5% 0.075 1.075 gives us a stock price of $20.29. This is fairly close to the price to earnings estimate, a little bit less optimistic. And let's take a look at the last one on slide 14. The price to sales ratio is calculated exactly the same way with different numbers. The sales per share in late 2009 was $6.76, $6.76. The 5-year average price to sales ratio was $3.14. And the price to share growth rate was expected to be 7%. So if we do the calculation, the historical price to sales ratio times the projected sales per share, and the projected sales per share are just the current sales per share times 100% plus our growth rate of 7%, we get 3.14 times $6.76 times 1 plus 0.07 or 1.07 and get $22.71. So this is a bit more optimistic, yes. And does it make sense that the earnings per share would be 92 cents and the cash flow per share would be $1.76 and the sales per share would be $6.76? Well, yes, it does. Think about it, folks. The earnings are reduced by whatever depreciation expense, and companies like Intel have huge depreciation expenses. Why? Because it cost them $2 billion to make the first chip. And after that, it cost them a couple bucks to make each chip. But so they have huge depreciation expenses to build the new, you know, they're always putting together new chips and new and improved and faster and faster and faster. And then, of course, they have to take away all the expenses from the sales per share to get down to the cash flow per share and the sales per share, and the earnings per share. So, let's see. Reality check. Can we reasonably assume that the formulas on the previous slides will give us realistic figures? Huh? Well, for many companies, yes. For many companies, no. But there are countless other factors at work. It's like trying to predict the weather, only worse. See, the major assumption of these models, as we've already stated, is that the price multiples will remain constant. However, we are using averages without taking into account the variances and the standard deviations of the averages. Do you remember them? Is it reasonable to expect predictions from these models to be accurate if the variances of the averages of the price multiples are large? In other words, if the PE is going up and down and up and down quite considerably. Does that make sense? On the price to cash flow and the price to sales. For the record, slide number 16, the price of Intel 1 year later in late 2010 was around $20.50. Not bad, eh? Well, 1 out of 4 ain't good. Because if you go back to the 3rd, 4th, and 5th editions for the next year prices of Intel, the predictions were far from their actual prices 1 year later. The 3rd edition was too low. The 3rd edition was predicting $19.61, $27.54, and $31.63. The actual price 1 year later was $33.50. So they were too low in the 3rd edition. I think my cat has got a bird. Oh, wonderful. Thank you very much, Sharp. My cat just brought a bird in. The fourth edition predictions and the fifth edition predictions were too high. The fourth edition was expecting the sky, $50.84 and $43.49 and $40.92, the corresponding price to earnings, price to cash flow, and price to sales models. And 1 year later was actually $17.50. In the fifth edition, the variance, I guess, got a little lower. And we had $25.47, $25.36, and $29.63, but the actual price 1 year later was $20. Notice that the third edition predictions were too low, the fourth and the fifth edition predictions were too high. Gives you lots of confidence in the price models, huh? Well, take heart. The predictions for Disney, a much less volatile company than a high-tech company such as Intel, were much closer to the actual prices. Okay, so it's time for a break. Go back over these, make sure you understand the concepts, but more importantly, the calculations. The calculations are easier than the concepts. And then, of course, we have a worksheet, two of them to be precise, to go through, and answer keys on the worksheets, commentaries, plus there's an assignment, which is hint, 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 very similar to the worksheets, which are very similar to these problems. And there may be an exam like this, there may be questions like this on the exam. Okay? Now, when we come back, folks, you are going to be treated to the best, in my opinion. And that doesn't mean much, to be truthfully, not my opinion, but the fact that these are the best models for predicting the valuation, because even they aren't that good either. But you're going to be treated to the dividend discount models. So see you next time.